Welcome to Wednesdays in the Word. This is a recording of our Wednesday morning Bible study held weekly at Chapel Hill and led by our Minister of Education, Casey Spigner. We walk each week verse by verse through the Scriptures, one book at a time. If you wish to join us in person, we meet each week at 10 a.m. in our sanctuary. We'd love for you to join us. Now let's open up God's Word together and see what God says to us today. All right, y'all, Daniel chapter 7, we might as well get into it. We're here. We made it. We made it through all of the things that were easier to teach and easier to cover in big chunks, and now we're going to slow down. We're going to grind to a halt here just a little bit as we get into chapter 7. Basically, we have looked through and we understand. We talked about this from the very beginning. The book of Daniel is divided into two sections. Chapters 1 through 6 are very narrative in their writing, which basically means they're telling stories. Daniel is writing and he's given us these clips and these big wide-ranging images, these dreams, these miraculous events that we've talked about. But he's doing it in big picture, so it's easier to teach. It's easier to walk through that way. Now, we get to chapter 7, and the next few chapters, chapter 7 through 12, are very different in content. We go from storytelling, and we go from narrative form writing. Now, we go to just straight prophecy. And it is as stark a contrast from one section to the next, just about as you can possibly have. So, again, we're going to slow down. Today we're going to cover 8 verses. And I know y'all are looking at me in the room thinking that's more like it. That's what we're accustomed to right there is 8 verses, 10 verses at a time. So, here we are, right? So, one of the commentaries that I was looking through over the last couple of days says that chapter 7 of Daniel is the most comprehensive and detailed prophecy of future events to be found anywhere in the Old Testament. All right, so we know that there are many prophets in the Old Testament, many books of prophecy in the Old Testament. And the commentator goes so far as to say of all of those in the Old Testament, this is the most detailed, it is the most comprehensive of all the prophecy. And so today we're going to look at the first 8 verses. Now we're going to compare them to what took place in Daniel chapter 2. And we're going to look forward to the book of Revelation, and we're going to see how these things lay out. Now, don't worry. I'm going to give you a little glimpse. I've got this up here for you now so you can see what all of these things represent in Daniel chapter 2. Don't worry about writing it down now because I'm fit to take it off. And Daniel 7 and where it points us toward to in Revelation, okay? So now, not only that, but I got some really cool pictures. Y'all see that? That's really cool. That's the best part right there. All right. So, Daniel chapter 7. Again, is this transition point. It is a moment where the writing becomes different. Now, there's also something else that we have to keep in mind. And I told y'all this 11 weeks ago, because this is lesson 11, in the very first lesson, chapter 2 through chapter 7 are written in Aramaic. Chapter 1, chapter 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 are written in Hebrew, which tells us, I don't know what it tells us exactly, but it tells us that this section, chapter 2 through chapter 7, were also written as a grouping, okay? So all of this that we've studied basically over the last 8-9 weeks has been pointing us to this section today. All of it is connected, I believe, or Daniel wouldn't have chosen to write that section in a different language. I don't know the meaning. I don't know. I'd have to go back. I didn't do that this morning. I apologize for that. You can go back and listen to podcast number 1 through Daniel. I probably explained it in there. All right. So now, also something that's different. Daniel has been writing about events that happened to other people, with the exception of Daniel in the lion's den. The majority of the writing has been things that happened to other people. I know in chapter 1, we had the whole deal with what they ate, how they trained, and all of that stuff. And Daniel was affected by that. But now, you think, the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, the writing on the wall, all of this was happening to other people. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego going into the fiery furnace, he's telling us the story of things that happened to other people. The main thing that we understand is the dreams that happened in the book of Daniel, chapters 2, chapters 4. Daniel is writing about what someone else saw and what someone else experienced. All right, chapter 6 is a little bit different because we get into this whole thing with Cyrus the Great or Darius the Mede, whatever you want to call him. And we get into this section where Daniel now is writing about things that happened to himself. from here on out, that's what's going to continue. Daniel is writing about first-person events, first-person things that happened to him, okay? So, he's writing today to tell us about a dream, not that Nebuchadnezzar had. It's hard to say all those names and keep them straight. Or Belshazzar had, or Darius had, or anybody else had. He's writing today to tell you about a dream that Daniel had. All right? So now, God is speaking to Daniel. This should not surprise us. This should not surprise us, right? We've seen things in Daniel's life that help us understand who he is, how faithful he is to God. Again, a couple of weeks ago, I told you one of the commentators called him one of the most faithful men in all the Bible, comparing him to where we see Job and that kind of stature, okay? So now, important stuff, all right? So now, whatever is about to happen, and look, y'all, I'm going to be honest. There's some scientific, science fiction-y kind of stuff that's going to sound like it's happening through this next few chapters. It's going to be weird. It's going to sound very much like Revelation. Some of the things that we don't understand when we read Revelation. Some of the things that John probably didn't understand when he was writing it down. He was just writing down what he saw, trying to describe it in the best language that he possibly could. And so Daniel, I believe, is doing some of the same thing. Now, he's going to talk about some creatures today. And there was an interesting thing that I read this morning. It was a quote. It was really good, okay? And it's basically that this book, this passage today, and this is the quote, is essentially a book of pictures, which is the reason I decided to try to... ChatGPT, y'all, is our friend today. ChatGPT created these images for us, okay? Is essentially a book of pictures appealing to our senses. We are meant to see, hear and smell. If I could have figured out a way for you to hear the pictures and smell them, I'd have done that too, just so you'll know. All right. The strange beasts that appear through this chapter. We are meant to be overwhelmed, and I added, and amazed, as Daniel was. All right. So the imagery, you're supposed to see it. You're supposed to visualize it. You're supposed to imagine, what in the world does a bear with three ribs in his mouth? What in the world does a great beast with 10 horns look like? What in the world does a leopard with four wings look like? Well, I'm going to try to show you. I'm going to be honest, ChatGPT didn't figure out what four wings meant. It's just a leopard with two wings. I know that. Okay, it's wrong, but it still gives you some idea. Okay? So now, let's get into it. Let's read it. Verses 1 through 8. Daniel chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. And Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts were coming from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. And I kept looking up. I kept looking until its wings were plucked. And it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and the three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. And after this, I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird, and the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth, and it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. All right, y'all got all that. Y'all got all that, right? Y'all don't need me to explain it, right? That makes all perfect sense. You know exactly what he's talking about when he writes all of that. Come on, come on. I thought for sure y'all knew, had all that figured out. I got to be honest with you, I've been studying since Monday, and I don't know that I've got it all figured out either. But here we go. We're going to try. We're going to do the best we can. All right, so we get to verse 1. In the year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream. All right, so the first thing you need to know, you're thinking, have we already covered Belshazzar? Didn't we already move on past him? The answer is yes. All right, so Belshazzar was back in chapter 5, I believe it was, and he appeared. Belshazzar is the one that had the writing on the wall, right? He was a short-termer. So this means that Daniel now is taking us back 15 to 20 some odd years. So in chronological order, chapter 7 happens before chapter 6, chronologically. All right, so now he's going back. So here's the reason we need to understand this. This now is personal. The personal nature of this, Daniel receives this vision himself. He's now not interpreting someone else's dream. And this takes us again from a different response, a different job, a different thing that's happening in his life. He's gone from being the chief interpreter, the chief of all the satraps and prefects and Chaldeans and all those other things. And multiple times, he keeps getting to be in charge. Why? Because he can interpret dreams. Well, now he's going to get to interpret his own. All right, he gets to now interpret his own and write all about it. All right, so what is the importance of this vision? First of all, we understand it must have been important. Why? Because Daniel wrote it down. Daniel wasn't wasting time. He wasn't filling up paper with things that didn't matter. And all of the things we've studied so far are significant. So we have to understand, if he went to the trouble of writing down these creatures, and look, let's be honest. If you're asleep and you start dreaming about these kind of things, it's one of two things. One, it's indigestion and you're having bad dreams, right? Or two, this vision has some symbol, some symbolism, some significance to it that is important for us to understand. So I'm going to go with that one, right? So we're going to understand this. Now, what is more significant about this? There's a belief that the first six chapters of Daniel, which we've already studied, all the things that have already taken place, the dreams, the taking a stand, the fiery furnace and the lion's den and all this other stuff, was written. He wrote all of this first to give us an understanding, one, of who he is. We learned a lot about Daniel. We learned a lot about Nebuchadnezzar. We learned a lot about Belshazzar. We learned a lot about a lot of people through this passage, right? But we learned a lot about Daniel. We got a lot of background. Why is that important? Because now he's going to start writing weird stuff. Sorry, it's biblical. I'm not saying it's not true, but he's going to start writing stuff that's hard to understand. He's going to start writing stuff that's hard to explain. And the first six chapters, the things that we've already studied, the things we've already read, give us credibility, give Daniel credibility with us. So we've read six chapters and 10 weeks of stuff about Daniel's life. Now we get to the hard stuff. We know who Daniel is. We have a background on Daniel. Could he have told it in order? Could he have fit it in between 5 and 6? Probably so. But now he's basically written two books. Now he's written all of this other stuff that gives us understanding. He's an interpreter. He's a believer. He's all of these things. And it makes these last few chapters more credible, more believable. All right? Think about it. Think to the book of Revelation. If you don't know John, if you don't understand John is, and some random guy starts writing some of the stuff that's in Revelation, it's hard to believe. It's already hard to understand. It's already hard to interpret, but it's hard to believe. But we know, based on the rest of the New Testament, who John is. So we have this understanding now, well, John, if John's writing it, John's on this island, John's doing these things, it must be some legitimacy to it. Daniel falls into this same category. I believe the first six chapters were written to give us a background, help us understand who he is. So now that he's going to write the hard stuff, we have this understanding of who it is. Now, here's the thing we got from verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, Daniel saw a dream and as he lay on his bed, and he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Y'all, we have to understand that we must take seriously what God reveals, even if it's symbolic. And listen, sometimes this is like other things of God, right? Even if it doesn't make sense, we still have to pay attention to it. We still have to listen to it. We have to still try to understand it, Because it doesn't, may not make sense to us in the moment, but we still have to try to understand it. We must take seriously what God reveals. Verse 2, Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. All right, so the first thing we need to know about that passage, that little verse right there, verse 2 says these four winds came from where? Heaven. All right, so this is kind of a deep thing, but the four winds of heaven implied this divine sovereignty. It implies that God is in control. It implies that of all the chaos that we're about to talk about, and most of it we've already talked about. Matter of fact, I'm going to show you on these other slides, we're not talking about anything new today. We're actually talking about something we've already talked about in chapter 2 when we talked about the bronze image that Nebuchadnezzar built. All of this is the same things, it's just from a different perspective, all right? But all of this, no matter the chaos, no matter what went, look, here's the thing, here's the takeaway. When the world seems out of control, turn on your news. When the world seems out of control, God is not out of control. When the world seems uncertain, when the world seems chaotic, God is not a God of chaos. God is a God of order. God is a God of control. God is He is sovereign. He is seated on the throne. And no matter what we're about to explain or try to figure out or try to understand, and it's the four kingdoms, it's people are in control and then they're out of control and somebody else comes in, through every bit of that, these four winds of the seas that it talks about here, the four winds of heaven that comes against the sea, is Daniel's way of saying through this dream, no matter what happens out here, this is all under the control of God. Nothing is happening that God is not aware of. And y'all, that's going to be the best thing I say today. That's the easiest thing to understand that I'm going to tell you today. Nothing happens that's outside of God's control. He may cause things to happen. He may allow things to happen. But he's never unaware of things that are happening. He's never caught off guard. Nothing ever happens without him at least going, well, I knew that was coming. Right? So that's how we have to... That puts the rest of this in perspective. That helps us understand the rest of this. Right? So when he talks about... I'm too far ahead. Though the sea is chaotic, the winds are from heaven, and God is in control. All right? So now, y'all, that gets us to the fun part. That gets us to the fun part now. So Daniel continues in his dream. Verse 3, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. All right? So now, I told you a minute ago, you think back to Nebuchadnezzar's golden image in chapter 2. And we talked about in chapter 2 that each of those different sections, remember head of gold, and then everything changed material, and they all represented different things that were coming. The dream that he had, all of this other stuff, it represented different nationalities that were going to come in and take over. These are the same nationalities that dream represented earlier. So when I tell you we're not breaking new ground, we're not telling you something new today. But what I am telling you is Daniel chapter 2 was the way that man perceived it. Daniel chapter 7 is the way that God perceives it. So the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2 was man's interpretation of something. Daniel chapter 7 is God telling Daniel exactly what it is that he sees, what it is that he thinks these things are represented by. So I'm gonna put all this on the screen as we go, and we'll walk through it, okay? So the first thing that we see in verse 4, the first was like a lion that had wings of an eagle. And he says, I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. All right, so that's pretty creepy right there, right? Can you imagine running into one of those jokers somewhere? We got a lion, which is scary enough already, and then you put some wings on it, and you think, well, dude, that thing can fly and chase me all over the place. That is scary right there, okay? I'm not looking forward to ever running into one of those if it happens, okay? So this is the first image that is represented here, all right? So this is, remember, the four beasts represent the four kingdoms that are represented coming up. All right. So the first one here. Here's some information, and it represents Babylon, and it represents Nebuchadnezzar. So again, you got to think back to chapter 2. In the gold image, he was the head of God. So Daniel interprets this dream and the gold, and it all represents the nation of Babylon. Now, we've talked about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 40-some-odd years, historically viewed as an excellent king. Not so much in the ways of God, but even then he had his moments. Even then he had his moments. And I believe by the end of his reign, if he wasn't a believer, he was at least he was a believer in who God was. He may not have been a sold out, born again Christian, but he had enough appreciation and understanding of who this God of the Bible was that he was willing to do things the way that he wanted. All right, so now in chapter 7, we see that this same Babylon, the same Nebuchadnezzar now, is represented by this lion with eagle's wings. All right? So, we understand both Jeremiah and Ezekiel, when talking about Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, compared them to a lion and to an eagle. This is probably the easiest one that interpreters had to figure out. All right? So, he was compared. But basically, they said he was as ferocious as a lion and as swift as an eagle. Let me put the picture back up there because that makes more sense when you can see it, right? Ferocious as a lion and swift as an eagle. And we obviously all know lions symbolize royalty. They symbolize power, that all of that. The lion, the king of the jungle, right? So now, the second thing we see is the lion with eagle's wings. So we understand this. The speed, the swiftness of conquest. He won victory quickly over the people that he fought against. All right? Now, we get to a section here in this verse. It says in verse 4, I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. So y'all remember the story of Nebuchadnezzar, right? Y'all remember back a few chapters. And basically, Nebuchadnezzar had a moment where he went crazy. Y'all remember that? We talked about that. Matter of fact, he spent a period of time in isolation, out in the desert. Remember, we talked about the fact he had a symptom, he had a disease where he literally thought he was cattle. It's not normal. It's not great. It's not a good look for the king of this great nation. Y'all, Babylon's big, y'all. Babylon's a big deal. All right? So here's this thing. He's off in isolation for a period of time. But what happened to him? Y'all remember? God restored him. So the plucked eagle's wings are a time where he had his power. He had this, I mean, not that a lion's not impressive, but it's not quite as impressive as that, right? So he had those wings, it says they were plucked and taken away, and that is symbolic of he had lost his power. He had lost his status. He had lost his position. So he's then sent off. But what happened to him? He's restored back to his kingship. He's restored back to a place of authority. He's restored back to a place of power. And he's given this. And look, and he gives God all the credit. He had this recognition of who God was. He kind of had an aha moment where he said, well, if I'd have just done this sooner, maybe I wouldn't have been eating grass for the last few years, right? This crazy thing goes on, but God restores him back. So the gold head, the head of gold in Daniel chapter 2 is how Nebuchadnezzar interpreted it or saw it and how Daniel interpreted it. But now God reveals it to Daniel as a lion with eagle's wings. Now, if you move forward into Revelation, how does this all play out? Where do you see it? You see it in Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 2. And just write that down. Go back and read it later. But it mentions all the animals. It mentions the lion. It mentions all of these things. But it is this imagery that God is going to fulfill, and we're going to see it again in the New Testament. We're going to see it again in the end times. All right? So the first animal, let's get one more look at it. I want y'all to remember that. I don't want y'all to forget what that looks like right there, because that is something else to behold, right? So there's the first one. All right? So we've got a lion with eagle's wings. God can humble and restore even the most powerful rulers, is what he's trying to show through that. All right, now let's get to the second one. Y'all thought that picture was something. Wait till you see this. Right? Something, well, see, this is ChatGPT, I don't know, right? But it says something like a bear with three ribs in its mouth. That's something like a bear. It's a bear. With three ribs in its mouth. All right? So what does this represent? The second animal. In Daniel chapter 2, you go back to this statue, right? And in chapter 2 of Daniel, what represented Medo-Persia, the Medo-Persian Empire, was a chest of arms and chest and arms of silver. Y'all remember that? Back into that, right? Now, we get here, and this is symbolized by a bear with three ribs in his mouth. Now, the Medo-Persian Empire, ferocious, powerful. But when you think of Nebuchadnezzar, you think of great king, powerful in stature and somebody. The Medo-Persian Empire, they were just as powerful and just as ferocious, but they weren't into all the crowns and the robes and the stateliness and all this other stuff. They just wanted power. They just wanted control. And they would get it however they had to get it. Now, it says tells us here in verse 5, "And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth." Okay? So, the raised up on one side symbolizes one side of that. Medo over the Persians was more significant. All right? So, the Medo Empire was more significant than the Persian portion of this empire that worked together. I got that backwards. Persia's dominance over the Medes. I got that wrong. My apologies. I should have read it instead of trying to remember it. This was an action that God allowed, that God inspired, that God took place and allowed to happen. Now, the three ribs. What are the three ribs in the mouth? I only see two, by the way, in this picture. ChatGPT can't count. It's fine. Just pretend like there's three. Just pretend like you'd be pretending if I didn't have a picture up there anyway, so it's fine. It's fine. All right, so now this symbolizes the fact that Medo-Persian Empire had three different conquests. They defeated a nation called Lydia, they defeated Egypt, and they obviously defeat Babylon, right? So the three ribs that are in the mouth of the bear, or something that resembles a bear, are symbolize these nations that they have defeated and taken over. All right. So again, in chapter 2, the Medo-Persian Empire was represented the same way, but it was represented by a chest and arms of silver. And now, here, from God's perspective, he sees this bear, one side higher than the other, with three bones in its mouth, representing Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon, the nations that the Medo-Persian Empire has overtaken and has overcome. This represents an appetite, the bones in the mouth. I mean, you ever seen a dog walk around with a bone just carried around? They're claiming ownership. My bone. You ain't taking my bone. You ever try to take a bone from a dog that had it in his mouth? I don't. Don't do that, by the way. And I would imagine a bear would be even worse. Bear's got a bone in its mouth. But there's a symbolism in this as well, and it represents this appetite. The Medo-Persian Empire was out for conquest. Again, we talked about it. They're not trying to be fancy. They're not trying to have the best palaces and the best, you know, most stately outfits and the most bejeweled crowns. They're looking for power. And this is all about conquest to them. So, I mean, what does it say at the end of verse 5? "And thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat," which is much better than another one that says much flesh. They were out, and it didn't matter who got in their way. They coming. They're going to be victorious. All right? So, animal number one was this, and it represents Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. All right? Animal number two is a bear with some bones in its mouth, and it represents the Medo-Persian Empire. Okay? Next. And here again, ChatGPT can't count. I only see two wings, but maybe there's four. Maybe I just can't see very well. We have a leopard. We have a leopard with wings, kind of like a lion with wings. That's just creepy. That's just weird. I wouldn't want to see a leopard in the wild. I would even less want to see one with wings. All right. So now, this is the third animal. And this represents for us the Greek Empire under the leadership of a man named Alexander the Great. All right. Alexander the Great, great ruler. Obviously, or they would have called him Alexander the Average. Alexander the Not Important. I don't know. But he was powerful. He was important for the Greek Empire. All right. He had this problem, though. When he got to 33, anybody know what happened to him? He died. Yeah, he was you know, taking names and being victorious and doing all these other things, but he died before he could get super far into his reign. Now, the four things, and I wish I had it written down. I read it and I thought I wrote it down in the notes and I didn't. When he died, the four wings represent the fact that his kingdom was divided up into four kingdoms. I read something yesterday. And it was kind of funny on Twitter, but it made me think of this. It was a meme that said, "I've come to grips with the fact that I'm replaceable at work, but I also know it would take four people to replace me." Here we go with Alexander the Great. He was capable of controlling this massive, massive area of land, but when he died, they divided that nation up into four nations and gave it to four different kings. So the leopard, again, we're pretending that that thing's got four wings. Leopard's fast. And maybe that describes his life, right? That it was over before it happened quickly. It was gone in a vapor. I don't know. But God is in control. God is in control. All of this shows us that God knew that the empire would not stay unified. God was aware. The four wings represent the fact that God knew when Alexander the Great was gone, it was going to be divided. It was going to be split. And that authority, y'all, where did that authority come from? It's granted. It's God allows this empire to rise, and he allows this empire or causes this empire to fall. All of this is still under the control of God. And still under his authority. All right, so now when you look forward, you can look. Revelation 13, Revelation 17, Revelation 19 through 22 is the answer for all of this. If you want to go find all of this stuff being talked about, you can see this here. Again, Revelation 13, 2 points specifically and mentions this one. Now, did y'all think those other animals were creepy? Those other beasts were weird? Y'all watch this. All right, so the fourth one. That's lovely. Right? Yeah, like Satan. Well, hang with me on that thought. Hang with me on that thought, because we're going to kind of get there for just a minute. The fourth beast, dreadful and different. Verses 7 and 8 say that he is terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. Had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. All right. You didn't count. 2, 3. Good. Finally. Finally they got one right. Right. All right. So we see this here. And this is, y'all, this is weird. This is the ugliest one to me. Right. So what's the representation here? The iron teeth echoes the legs of iron in Daniel chapter 2. So we had legs of iron in Daniel chapter 2 that represent the Roman Empire. And in chapter 7, we see the beast with iron teeth. So the iron is the common denominator there. Okay. So this iron obviously is something that is significant. But it likely represents, again, the Roman Empire or a broader, basically anti-God. The Roman Empire was not into the God of the Bible. They had their own thing. They had their own ways. A lot of the things that we study still come from the Roman Empire. Now, we know that Paul, we know that these missionaries went into Rome and did these amazing things, right? But the Roman Empire had no positive view of our God, the God of the Bible. So, we keep reading. The 10 horns. Horns symbolize kings or kingdoms, and it's possibly a future confederation of like this revival. I'm just reading these words. Revival of Roman-like power. That maybe something great is going to happen again in this nation in one day to come. All right? So we've got this. Now we see this revelation. If we go to Revelation 13, we see this beast from the sea. And it has what? It has 10 horns. And it's blasphemous. In other words, it is against the things of God. It is completely anti-God. But now listen, when we get to verse 8, this is where this starts to get interesting. Now, I mean, it's been interesting, I hope. But this is something fascinating that takes place in verse 8. Verse 8 says, "While I was contemplating the 10 horns, behold, another horn. A little one came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts." Now, I don't have a picture of that, okay? What does this little horn represent? Antichrist. Represents the Antichrist that we clearly read about when we get over into Revelation. All right? But now, 2 Thessalonians 2:3 refers to this arrogant speaking, this blasphemous ruler who gets his own horn, right? And it refers to him, quote, as a man of lawlessness, and again, as a quote, the son of destruction. So this 11th horn, this small horn that's added here, is pointing forward to where we're going to see when we get into Revelation, the Antichrist. Now let's go ahead. Y'all know these things, right? You don't know who it is. We hear speculation from time to time. Oh, so and so, he's probably the Antichrist. We don't have any idea. What we do know about Antichrist from our studies is that he is going to be a powerful guy. He's going to be a smooth talker. He's going to get the entire world to buy into his way of doing things. But at the end of the day, he's going to be a horrible, horrible dude, right? He's a representative of Satan that's going to be in control of the earth for a period of time. This horn, this last horn. And basically it tells us of these 10 horns, 3 are going to be uprooted and overthrown and displaced by this Antichrist. Now look, y'all, I confess to you that this was and has been a 30,000 feet helicopter overview of what's happening here. And we're going to get deeper into this as we go. But also, there's a couple more things that we need to understand that's going to point forward to. All right? We know back in Daniel chapter 2, we had this pointing forward to a future kingdom. And in this future kingdom, it was represented in Daniel chapter 2 as feet of iron and clay. And there was division, right? Daniel chapter 7 mentions this 10 horns with a little horn and the Antichrist. And this is a future kingdom that's going to be set up. It is what earth is going to look like at some point in time under the control of Antichrist, under control of not anything good. And look, I'm just going to be honest. If y'all think today is bad, if you think right now is bad, it's not even going to begin to compare. Now, we can get into pre-tribulation and post-tribulation and all of that other stuff, and that'll be another discussion for another day. But will we be here for it? Depends on what you believe and how you believe it, and that's why we're not getting into it today, right? But there's another period of time that is coming where something different is going to happen. But ultimately, y'all know this, right? There's going to be another kingdom. There's going to be another kingdom, a victorious kingdom, God's kingdom. Daniel chapter 2 was represented, it was mentioned as the stone that crushed the statue. Well, that's symbolism, isn't it? The statue that represented all these other earthly kingdoms, and this stone is going to come through and knock it out. But here, it's represented as the Son of Man. We haven't really gotten to the Son of Man yet. We're going to get to the Son of Man as we come, but the Son of Man is going to receive this eternal kingdom, right? This reign where Christ returns to earth and reigns here on earth. Maybe the new earth. But we know that that's going to take place. We see that and read Revelation 19, 20, 21, 22, and you can see all of that and in all of its glory. All right? So again, a 30,000 foot overview here, but here's some key things that we need to understand as we prepare to wind down. The first thing, empires rise and fall at God's command. And we said it earlier, we started with the fact that God is sovereign. No nation takes place, no nation has anything without God giving it to them, without God allowing it. And we see that God is not surprised by power, by world disputes, by corruption, by all these things. We see things going on in the world with Putin and Zelensky. God's not surprised. He's not caught off guard by any of that. We see this stuff going on out in Los Angeles and San Antonio and San Francisco and all of this stuff going on. God is not caught off guard by any of this. God's not caught off guard by elections. God's not caught off, is not surprised by anything that's taking place in our world. Worldly kingdoms versus God's kingdom. We've talked a lot about earthly kingdoms that were set up in this passage today. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Roman Empire, the Greeks, all of these groups. In earthly powers, there's a reason they're represented by those things, right? Earthly power is exactly that. It's earthly. It's beastly. It's always out for self. It's always out for what's best for me. It's always out for doing these other things. Y'all look at these things. Those are not nice, cuddly little creatures. We ain't got poodles and hamsters and little tiny lizards and all this other stuff, koala bears. That's not what we're getting to represent these things, right? These things are evil and these things are bad, and they represent earthly kingdoms. But God's kingdom, again, one day is going to be set up, and it's going to be glorious, and it's going to be eternal, and it's going to last forever. And then the last thing we see is just this encouragement to the faithful. No matter what's going on around you, God sees. God's in control. We can worry about the presidents, and we can worry about governors, and we can worry about nations. We can worry about all these things in this world. We have no control over any of it. You and I have no control. The best thing we can do for any of it is to pray for it. The best thing we can do for any situation is to pray for it. One of the things that drives me crazy, somebody walk up to you and say, well, I'm praying for you. The least I can do is pray for you. Lord, no, it's not. That's one of the most important things you can ever possibly do for me, is pray for me. And I for you. So don't ever say, well, it's not much, but at least I'm praying. You're approaching the throne of heaven for whatever that issue is. When these things going on around the world, we're praying for conflicts around the world. We're praying for civil unrest in our nation. We're praying for things that are going on around us. Pray for it. God's in control. God is not wringing his hands over what's going to happen in Los Angeles over the next few days, y'all. He's not. He's not worried about Russia that's not the right way to say it. He's not unaware of what's going to happen between Russia and Ukraine. He knows. Is he worried about it? Yes, I believe he cares about people, but he ain't worried about it to the point like, I don't know what's going to happen. That's not how God works. The thing we need to be doing is praying. And look, here's the beauty of this whole thing, right? We're going back 2,500, 3,000 years into this history right here. It's unfolding just like we talk about, just like the book says. Everything's happened just like the book says. It's going to happen just like the book says. We talked about Israel last week, the things of Israel, the things that Scripture tells us about Israel. We see it. We're watching it. It's happening. This book is happening. Look, God wrote this book. God inspired this book by however many authors he inspired to write it. A bunch. And it's playing out. It's just exactly what it says it is. It's not changing. It's not wrong. We're not looking at Scripture and going, well, it says that was going to happen, but that was wrong. You ever said that about something in Scripture? No. Why? Because it's happening. It's playing out right in front of us. And it gives us the encouragement that this, which God's book, God's Word promises, is going to happen one day. Right? If the rest of it's true, if the rest of it's playing out just like it says, Guess what, y'all? That is too. God's in control. God's in control. God's in control. Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed listening to what God had to say to us. If you have any questions about today's Bible study, you can call our church office at 205-339-4071, and we will be glad to answer any questions you might have. God bless you, and we hope to see you again next week.